time to talk to a former guest on the show, Britain's top forensic pathologist, bar none, I think, Dr. Richard Shepherd, who joins us now. Morning, Richard. Nice to have you back on.
Good morning to you. Yes, I'm not sure my colleagues would agree with that description.
I was just saying earlier on, if we had to form a top 10 of forensic pathologists, I'm not sure such a thing exists, but I'd put you right up there, Richard.
Oh, well, thank you, Bill. I will take that as the greatest compliment.
Now, since we last spoke, about your book, Unnatural Causes. I believe you did a theatre tour based on that book. Is that right?
No, that's just coming up, actually. Starts in October to November. Yeah, that's a real departure for me. Not lecturing students who look a bit bored, but hopefully entertaining crowds of people with some stories of my life.
How wonderful. And is this something that's been planned for a while but had been put off because of the dreaded COVID?
Yeah, that's right. It was planned for last year and it was COVIDed off, so we've been delayed a year and really looking forward to it. So, say, starting beginning of October in Shrewsbury.
Goodness me. Do you have any exhibitions of stuff to show people, or will it all be slides and pictures?
No, we are a little limited to by law and various regulations, but I hope, you know, we're going to tell some interesting tales. We're going to in solving what might be a crime or might not be a crime, so there'll be interest for everyone.
There was that bizarre Hagen's, that whole exhibition of stuff, which was rather gory.
Yeah, I mean, it Bodyworks, I think it was called.
Yes.
Wasn't it? Yeah, I mean,
yes.
Interesting guy. I have to say, it really wasn't for me, but loads and loads of people were absolutely fascinated by it.
Now, in this new book, which is called The Seven Ages of Death, you've gone through some never-before-told cases, and not so many of them high-profile, but there's a couple in there that I thought I'd have to run by you. It's a slightly different book from last time, but there's a couple of still quite high-profile people in there, particularly as we now talk about Iraq. One of them has a particular resonance.
Yeah, David Kelly. Yeah, poor man. He was really caught up in the dodgy dossier event and was really, I think, hung out to dry in the Commons by various people.
Yes,
and poor man, I think, felt just couldn't stand the strain and the stress. We talk about his death and the conspiracies that always seem to follow on from these things about what's going on, and try and set the record straight for this poor man.
And just explain to us how you can revisit something so long afterwards. I mean, you did that brilliant series on TV where you did kind of celebrity autopsies and kind of look back on things. How do you revisit something that's in the past?
Well, I rely, as historians do, on documentation.
Right.
What people have written at the time, what photographs were taken at the time, and not just the official things, but the unofficial things. They're often much more interesting and much less likely to be staged or altered or written from a particular point of view. So we go as wide as we possibly can with all the information. There's the Hutton Inquiry, of course, had loads of stuff, but other documents we can look at too. So we can really build up good pictures of what's gone on.
How detailed is your note-taking then when you're doing something like this? Are you filming the autopsy at the time? Are you recording stuff on computer? Are you taking notes? How does it actually work?
I'm afraid we're antediluvian, really. We write notes on bits of paper.
Wow.
That is much more secure. Some of my colleagues dictate as they work. We don't film because actually that's remarkably unuseful, because there is always someone standing between the camera and the bit you want to see.
Right.
It's like CCTV. It never shows exactly what you want to see. Loads of still photographs are taken, so it's well documented visually, it's well documented in words, and these reports are what I go back to. I've got, you won't be surprised perhaps here, I have a storeroom full of folders and files with all these things in, and you know, I can go back and with those things I can reconstruct what's gone on.
Some of them are high profile, like David Kelly, Gareth Williams, the young MI6 operative who was found, bizarre story, a spy in the bag, as they called it in the tabloid frenzy afterwards.
Yes. Yeah, very, very interesting. I mean, the book looks at, you know, what happens to us as we're born and as we grow old, what diseases can affect us, what injuries we can do, whether we harm ourselves, whether other people harm us. And this changes over the seven ages. Of course, I'm linking back there to Shakespeare's seven
of
ages,
course.
In As You Like It,
yeah.
You know, from mewling and puking in your mother's arms to sans eyes, sans teeth, sans everything, something I'm sliding closer towards than I particularly. But yeah, so seven ages, and interestingly, how it all changes over time, how these things affect us in different ways. So that's what we're looking at.
And apart from the ones that people will have heard of, there's the normal everyday person there, and there's often sadness involved in some of the stuff you have to look at. And there's a particular one which touched me, which is about a mum, a dad, and two teenagers in the run up to Christmas. An awful story, and you were able to exonerate,
yes.
I think, yes. the mum. There weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, often these things do start as awful stories, and it's my job to put the puzzle together. It's my job to understand what's gone on, to look at the body, of course, look at the injuries, of course, but also to look at the background. That's the psychological profile, a bit of what's going on, and the physical profile at the scene. Put all these things together, make the jigsaw tell a story. And in that particular case, it looks absolutely like it was going one way and mum was going to go to prison for murder.
Yeah.
And actually, in the end, that's not quite what happened, although there was an awful lot going on in that family that was really dysfunctional, that needed work and help and support, but not for me in that situation.
I guess that in a lot of cases, the press in particular, and sometimes the police, you know, are desperate to pin a murder on somebody, but a lot of time you discover that deaths are self-inflicted.
Yeah, well, I don't think the police are desperate to pin a murder, but obviously that's the thing they have to keep their eye on.
Yeah.
You know, they have to make sure they're covering their bases. So if it does turn into a murder, they've done everything correctly. Mm-hmm. And they're bound by very strict rules of what they can do and can't do, and they've got to play by those rules. If they cut a corner, they will be pilloried, and it may even lose them a conviction that should have occurred. So they're really bound by it, and they have to focus on the worst, but equally I have to look at the whole and say, no, we can move in a different direction. But if I think it's a murder, you know, we all go in the same direction and we push for a conviction.
For those who didn't hear our last interview, you are a kind of life pathologist. You always wanted to be a pathologist, and you use this expression, which has kind of touched me, actually. You said that your mother abandoned you by dying young, which is a really interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, I think that's a little cruel on my poor mum. I mean, she didn't have a choice. She had an infection when she was a child, which led to the chronic damage to her heart valves, and she died. Now, the trouble was, I was nine, and I wasn't really aware of what was going on. And at nine, no one really explained to me. And when she died, to my eyes, as a child of nine, she just suddenly disappeared from my world with
yes.
no good explanation. It was how things were done in the early 1960s. You know, I think it's done very, very differently now, and quite correctly. You know, children are brought into these discussions and are helped and supported. But for me, she suddenly disappeared. And that was very hard, actually harder, bizarrely, in late to cope with than it was perhaps as a nine-year-old when I just got on with living.
Yeah, interesting. As the years went on, I guess you become hardened to looking at dead bodies. In the beginning, do you have to be a particular kind of person, Richard, to not want to just sit there and throw up when you did your first one?
Well, I think there is. I mean, do surgeons do that? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think there is that professional component to our lives. And we started off, of course, in medical school. I talk about this in the new book, in the seven ages, you know, going to medical school and what that meant, and actually having to go through that, a bit of a rite of passage, but it was also learning about how fascinating the human body is, how it all works together, how
you
know, we all have muscles in the same place and nerves and arteries in the same place. So there is that process. I mean, yes, it was hard. The first post-mortem I did myself was hard, was difficult. But, you know, I was helped and supported by my colleagues through it. And that then set the trend. And it becomes a professional approach to these things. It's not dehumanized, because there is always that memory.
Yes.
But there is that separation. And you have to have that as a doctor to work with your patients.
many crime writers would describe someone who's dead, maybe in their face, you know, they'd be left with a kind of expression of fear or of pain on their face. You kind of counter that by saying, actually, that's not strictly true. They always look quite peaceful.
Yes, they do, because after death, the muscles all relax.
Yeah.
And the face assumes actually quite a calm expression. I've always thought, even in people who have died in the most horrendous situations, their faces after death are calm. And I must admit, I take some solace from that, that, you know, hopefully that once we have moved through that moment, there is a calm period that we can descend or move into.
Yeah. I note that you don't want to be asleep personally when your body finally succumbs. Is that right?
No. And, you know, it's the last great adventure. It's going to come to us all.
Yeah.
I think I might be a bit disappointed if I'm asleep. I'd like to be sat in a chair reading a good book, possibly with a whiskey and soda by my side,
nice.
But I'm not entirely sure. Nice. I'm not entirely sure about that, but it's, you know, certainly, no, I'd like to be there and experience it.
Well, it's interesting you say that. My mother, God rest her soul, always used to say to me, I don't want to wake up in the morning and be dead. And of course, that's exactly what did happen to her. She died in her sleep and of course didn't wake up in the morning. So, you know.
That's true. But, I mean, as long as it was peaceful and calm, you know, that's the important thing.
Absolutely. And you kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, as one gets older, maybe one's own mortality looms large. And I think for you, you've started to look at that a little more, as you would look at specific organs and go, goodness me, that liver looks quite interesting, but mine must be shot to bits after lockdown.
Well, yes, you know, there is that moment. You know, I'm not yet at 70, but I'm getting closer to it, you know, when you suddenly think there's this wonderful medical word called senescence, which
right.
just means sort of the slow change of age. And that's what I'm aware of. I've got a bit of arthritis in my knees. I've had prostate cancer, which has been treated, you know, and you're suddenly thinking, hang on a minute, this body that was served me so well for 60 plus years, you know, is beginning to show signs of wear and tear. But it's normal. That's how the process goes. And of course, I've seen it in all seven ages throughout my professional career.
And tell us how lockdown has been for you. It's been a bizarre time for all, but I mean, has your work kind of changed? Has it dropped away? What's happened in terms of your work?
Well, I've retired from doing the on-call police work before lockdown, so that was good. So my work level has continued. I've noticed there's been a few more domestic murders that I've had to go and give opinions on. But my life, in a sense, hasn't changed. Other than I've noticed that my alcohol consumption did increase. And when that came to my attention, we had to do some sort of serious talking to ourselves in the mirror. Serious discussions to say, whoa, hang on, you know, this really needs to be looked at and you've got to do something about it. So that was just interesting to note, Bill, you know, that you could slide down that road so simply and so easily. Needed a bit of thought to sort it.
I think you're not alone in that thought of it, to be fair, Richard. But most of us wouldn't be thinking, goodness me, my liver used to look like a sleek stingray, but now look, it's going to be a right old mess.
Well, I do say, I hope I never get to see my own liver, but you know, you're right. You know, when you have that inside knowledge, if I could put it that way, you know, you do get, and you know, as I had this scare and had to have a CT scan after I fell off a ladder, you know, and they started saying, oh, there's something wrong with your liver.
No.
You know, the immediate panic was, oh dear.
Yeah.
Fortunately resolved and all sorted. But it's, you know, you have to, I think if a doctor can't talk about what's going wrong with them and their illnesses, and just say, whoa, it happened to me. Come on, get down, see your doctor, get it sorted.
Absolutely.
Because we can cure these things. Now.
Absolutely.
That's the important thing.
When we last spoke, I mentioned we had a common love, and that's of flying light aircraft. You've been doing it since 2004, much like me. You've been doing it since I'm about 21 years old. But, you know, latterly, it's become more and more difficult, and I guess almost impossible in terms of the last couple of years.
It's been very, very, very difficult, although I was really fortunate, Bill. I managed to get an excellent trip flying across France almost to the Swiss border to see my brother who lives out there. So I managed in between the lockdown periods to get a superb trip in. And I live on the memories of that trip and look forward next year to some other great trips around the continent. Perhaps getting down to Spain and seeing the coast down there. It'd be wonderful.
Lovely. Couldn't be further away from what you do as a day job. And I've noticed as well with interest that you're a beekeeper as well in your spare time.
Absolutely, yeah. God, I can see the girls whizzing out of their hives now, making honey for me. So it's fantastic. No, good time of the year to think about the honey I'm going to get off them soon.
Absolutely, and I guess they weren't bothered at all by lockdown. They just carried on working hard like they always do.
Absolutely, and it's good. It's good to see them going in and out of the hives, happy as bees.
Not many worker bees on furlough then in your household.
No. We had a strict rule: no furlough. They had to keep going.
As always, it's been brilliant to talk to you. I certainly hope that your theatre tour goes well. Wish we could come and see it, but here we are stuck. Unless you bring it to Europe, you can fly down and do as a special performance, Richard.
That sounds like a good plan, Bill. Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you.
And to you. The Seven Ages of Death, Dr. Richard Shepherd on TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.